Okay, so let's get started. Does everybody have the source sheet? Please email if you do not have the source sheet, and we'll see what we can try to help you with. Hi, Yosef, my nephew. Okay, tonight's shiur is about Chag Gadya. You obviously all showed some interest. It's tonight for me. Good morning or good afternoon to you, wherever you're logging in from. But there are a few other night-timers here in Israel. This year is about Chag Gadya, the famous song at the end of the Seder, called Symbolism and History. And obviously everybody had some level of interest in the song, which is why you probably signed up. A little bit of background about the song, and then we're going to tonight to try and understand perhaps its significance, some of its meaning, some of the symbolism attached to it, and why it might be the conclusion to Leil HaSeder. After all, this is a serious event, the Seder night, with a lot of content, many mitzvot that we need to fulfill. And we end with a song which, at least on first glance, does not seem directly connected to the plot of the rest of the evening. Does anybody know when Chag Gadya entered into the Haggadah? Is it one of the parts of the Haggadah that we have recorded in the Mishnah? Is it one of the early parts of the Haggadah? Does it appear in the Haggadot of the Gaonim, of Rashi and his students? Anybody know? Thank you, David. Is this better? Does anybody know when Chag Gadya entered into the Haggadah? It's a relatively late addition into the Seder night. Most of our content of the Seder and the structure of the Seder, the major content of Magid and the order of the mitzvot is discussed in the Mishnah and Masachet Pesachim. The Gemara discusses it. We have earlier versions of the Haggadah from the period of the Gaonim. We have in the early Middle Ages versions of the Haggadah. But most of the songs that we end the Seder with, including Chag Gadya, are what we would call relatively late additions, 16th century usually and on. Chag Gadya in particular entered the Haggadah in the 16th century. So first of all, you won't find it in any earlier Haggadot, and you won't find any commentaries to it in all of the earlier Haggadah commentaries. In 17th, 18th, 19th century commentaries to the Haggadah, very often you'll find a lot of interest in Chag Gadya and the other later songs that enter into the Haggadah. It's a folk song, right? And it's a folk song of the style that we know in English some variations of. Anybody think of a song like this? It's called a cumulative song, I think, in the technical folk song language. It's based on medieval German folk songs. But we have some like this in English, where one thing leads to the other, leads to the other, leads to the other. Can anybody, by mic or chat, think of any in English? Right, they're not Shirei Kodesh. What might they be? I know there was an old lady who swallowed a fly. Anyone come up with another one? The house that Jack built. Excellent, right? This is the same style. One thing and then to the other and then to the other and to the other. And there's a whole genre of these kind of folk songs in the Middle Ages. Chag Gadya is clearly derived from that genre. But how does it end up at the end of our Haggadah? And more importantly, once it ended up at the end of our Haggadah, how did scholars and rabbis through the later 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century look at it? First of all, did they take it seriously? Right? Is this something that's worth including? What happens if we don't take it very seriously? Is there any problem with that? And what symbolism and meaning was attached to it to try and turn it from more than a folk song to something meaningful and an appropriate end of the Leil HaSeder? Of course, it's been suggested that Chag Gadya, along with most of the other songs at the end of the Seder in the Nirtza section, function to help keep the children awake while the hour is getting very, very late and we may be losing our audience. But still, the question needs to be asked, if these songs are chosen to keep the children awake at the end of the Seder night, there obviously must be some Seder-relevant or Yetziat Mitzrayim-relevant significance to their inclusion. So that's our goal for tonight, to try and understand what the song might offer us as far as meaning and symbolism. Just to quickly refresh anybody's memory who's not familiar with the content of the song, and then we'll plunge into the sources that we have. Right? The song is written in Aramaic with some scattered Hebrew. It's not pure Aramaic. It's written in Aramaic, and it's called Chad Gadya, One Little Goat, One Little Kid, and it's the refrain is one little kid that Abba bought, that Dad bought, for two zuzim, for two coins. And then what happens to this poor goat? Along comes the cat, who eats the goat, and then comes the dog, who bites the cat, who ate the goat, and then comes the stick, who hits the dog. You get the picture, right? And after the stick, the fire burns the stick, and then the water puts out the fire, and the ox comes and drinks the water, and then the shochet comes and kills the ox, and finally the angel of death kills the shochet, and who settled accounts with the angel of death? None other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, King of Kings, comes at the end of the day to settle all of the accounts. What we'll try and look at are some of the approaches to trying to understand the meaning of this seemingly simple song and trying to attach some Pesach significance to it. Did the person who was trying to find the source sheet, are you able to follow the link from technical support? Please try. We're going to begin looking at the source sheet. We're starting with source number one. It's an interesting tshuva from the response to literature, a tshuva by the Chidah, Rav Chaim Azulai, 18th century, very prolific writer, posek, rabbinic leader, thinker, lived, born in Jerusalem, traveled very widely, spent a good period of his life in Italy, aware of traditions in both Ashkenazic communities, Sephardic, Eastern communities as well. And he was asked the following question. Somebody asked him, and we're not going to read word for word, somebody related to him about somebody who was mitlotzet, somebody that scoffed, mocked, made fun of this song, Chad Gadya, that is customary in Ashkenaz to say at the end of the Seder night. Excuse me, I have to sneeze. Maybe not. I'm sorry. And what happened to this scoffer, to this mocker? Somebody in his company stood up and excommunicated him. And the question that was asked to the Chidah is this excommunication of the person who mocked and made fun of this silly song, Chad Gadya, and its inclusion at the Seder night by Ashkenazic Jewry, is this a real excommunication? Was this justified, or was it not? And, of course, the Chidah answers the question to say that it's not a simple business to make fun of and to mock a song like Chad Gadya that was included throughout Ashkenazic Jewry for the last few centuries, and great rabbis and great scholars included it. And he feels very strongly that the person who blasphemed, basically, and cursed and made fun of this song deserves to be punished. And he continues with some very, very strong words that he's convinced that this song must have deep and profound meaning. First of all, otherwise he can't justify its inclusion, and more importantly, he can't justify the fact that great rabbis at the end of the Seder night took the time to say this song and sing this poem, and that therefore his conclusion is not only was excommunication justifiable in the case of the mocker, but that this poem must have great, deep, profound, hidden meanings, perhaps even Kabbalistic or esoteric meanings, and that it's our job to look for them and not to mock them. Tonight we won't go into deep Kabbalistic meanings, but we will take his message. I'm purposely not reading some of the pertinent portions from there. Thank you for your comment. Because I want to be able to focus on the pertinent portions in source 2 and spend most of our time on the chart. I'm just trying to balance my time. But I brought it because it's a fascinating tshuva. It's a fascinating question and answer that was asked to a rabbi in the 18th century, two centuries or so after the inclusion of Chad Gadya in the Haggadah, in the songs at the end of the Haggadah. And it raises all of the relevant questions. How seriously do we have to take a song like this, right? This is not anybody who's mocking Pesach Matzah U'Maror, part of the Seder. This isn't anybody who's scoffing and making fun of the four cups of wine or making fun of why we have Charoset. Nobody's making fun of any of that. But when it comes to the end of the Seder, right, this person could not understand the value and just could not find religious significance in this adapted German folk song sung at the end of the Seder. And the Chida's answer, I think, is an interesting answer, which is, number one, if he's mocking it, he must not understand the deeper meanings, and number two, the mocking deserved the punishment that it received. Source number two is from the Haggadah commentary of Rav Menachem Kasher, famous author in the early 20th century in New York City of the Torah Shlema, a very, very extensive collection of Midrashim to most of Chumash. He also wrote a very comprehensive commentary to the Haggadah, Haggadah Shlema, collecting, again, fragments of many Midrashim and ancient commentaries and medieval commentaries to the Haggadah. And he tries to suggest a few different ways or a few different rabbinic sources on which the song of Chagadia can be best understood. And he points us to three different rabbinic sources, and that's what we want to look at right now, that he thinks may help us understand the meaning of Chagadia. And after that, we'll move into the chart. The chart are four different suggestions in 18th, 19th century commentaries to the Haggadah of how to look at the symbolism and the meaning of the song of Chagadia. He opens up by quoting us a Mishnah from the second chapter of Pirkei Avot, and he suggests that the intention of the author of Chagadia may have been to allude to the statement in this Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. It's a Mishnah taught in chapter 2 of Pirkei Avot as one of the teachings of Hillel, and the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot has a fuller version than what he brings here, right? The Mishnah begins that Hillel saw a skull floating on top of the water. And is anybody familiar with Hillel's reaction when he sees a skull floating on top of the water? Anybody want to speak in or write in Hillel's reaction? What did he say to this skull, Hillel, the great sage? Unfamiliar? He judges it. Very good. How does he judge this skull? Right? He explains to the skull why he's floating in the water, right? Why he was beheaded and drowned in the water. Right. Right. Very good. Thank you, David Sal. We have a lot of Davids here tonight. He explains based on the principle of midah keneged midah. And he explains to him in Aramaic, right? He says, al de'atfat atfuch, because you sunk, they sunk you. And the end of those who sunk you is to be drowned themselves. And Rav Kasher explains how that Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, how Hillel's teaching of you, the skull, received your due reward, but don't worry, those who did it to you will also receive their due reward, could be related to Chagadia. And let's start with the second line after the quote from Pirkei Avot. Rav Kasher says as follows, Ki hem lo nitkavnu ligmol lecha kirishatcha, Ela miroa libam hitbi'ucha. What's the problem, says Hillel, to the skull? What's the problem with the people that decapitated you and sunk you? The problem is that, why did they do this to you? Were they punishing you for you sinking the previous person and killing the previous person? No. Rather, miroa libam. They did it out of their own evil. They weren't doing this out of a sense of fulfilling God's justice in the world, but rather out of their own sense of evil or hatred. And then he makes the link to Chagadia. He says, Ka hashunra. Likewise, the cat in Chagadia, who goes and eats the goat that Abba bought for 2 zuzim. Ru'uya hayta omnam le'onesh al torfat ha'gdi. The cat truly deserved to be punished for eating this gdi, for eating the little kid that God brought, the father brought. But, aval lo l'chach nitkaven ha'kelev. But when the dog bit the cat, he didn't really plan to punish the cat for his misdoing by eating the goat, but rather, why did the dog eat the cat? Bite the cat? Because dogs like to bite cats. Vilachain af hu loke. And therefore, the dog too deserves to be punished. And how does the dog get punished? The dog gets punished because what comes to hit the dog? The stick comes to hit the dog. And again, the stick deserves punishment in the real world of justice. This because the stick hit the dog. But why did the stick hit the dog? Not in order to set the record straight to punish the dog for hurting the cat who ate the goat, who shouldn't have done that. So because each element in the song, suggestive of Kasher, like this floating skull in the story of Hillel in the Mishnah, but because each element in the song acted out of their own interest and not because they're actually trying to punish the previous element, therefore each one deserves to be punished. And Rav Kasher concludes in that paragraph, v'chein hala, and so on, from the dog to the stick to the end of the story, and he quotes a verse from Kohelet, ki gavoh me'al gavoh shomer u'gvohim alehem. What's the conclusion? Because way up above, above the guard, is an even, right, higher guard. Right? God, Melech Malchem Lachim, is above all of these and is constantly watching and meeting out justice. Uchshiavo HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'yishchat l'malach hamavet yasir dima me'al kol panim. And when God, at the end of the story, comes and kills the Malach HaMavet, the angel of death, then God, and he borrows the verse that we... Yes, it's exactly the parallel to the Mitzvim. It's exactly the parallel, and that would be, thank you for your comment, that's exactly why, right, we would, according to this reading of it, why we would recite this at the end of Leil HaSeder, that we're making the connection to the Egyptians. I just want to finish summarizing his last line, right, that when God comes, according to Rav Kasher, at the end of the song and punishes and kills out the Malach HaMavet, then God removes tears and death from the picture for eternity. Right, so here, according to Rav Kasher, what we have is a story based on Hillel's principle in the Mishnah that those who are punished for a reason, and that those who punish them deserve to be punished, and if their intentions were not clear, and they were selfish, or they were not motivated for the sake of meeting out God's punishment, then don't worry, they too will be punished, and ultimately at the end of the process, of course, God comes in to set the record straight and to justly punish. And, of course, the parallel on the Seder night then would be, right, the Egyptians who, whether or not, as David suggests, functioned as God's mode of meting out justice, or even Paro with his hardened heart as the plagues went on, the Egyptians who caused suffering to the Jews, met their fate, they were punished, and those perhaps who punished them may have also received punishment throughout the ages, but at the end of time, don't worry, comes the message, God will come and set the record straight, and God can be counted on. That's one rabbinic source that Rav Kasher suggests may add meaning and significance to the message of Chag Gadya. But then he points to two others, and I'd like to explore those two others for a minute, and then to go into the four later 18th, 19th century commentaries that offer panoramic views of Chag Gadya. So the second paragraph, please, of source number 2 from the Haggadah Shlema of Rav Kasher. Umatzinu dugmato b'midrash. He says that we find a parallel midrash, and this midrash is very frequently cited in some of the contemporary commentaries to the Haggadah when they discuss Chag Gadya. It's a midrash from Bereshit Rabbah speaking about Avraham Avinu. And it's speaking about Avraham Avinu in the time of his life when he was still not living in Eretz Yisrael and still surrounded by Avodah Zarah, idolatry all around him, and how he reacted to that. And the Midrash has a non-recorded dialogue between Avraham Avinu and Nimrod, King Nimrod. Amar le Nimrod la Avraham. Nimrod said to Avraham, Niskod Lenura, let's worship fire. They're looking for an appropriate god, one of the strongest forces in the world. And remember that in the pagan world, right, the ancient world of polytheism, you chose a god based on strength or based on force, and there could be multiple gods who deserve to be worshipped because each one may have different strengths and forces. So Nimrod suggests to Avraham that a good god would be fire. After all, fire is a very powerful force. Amar le Avraham, v'niskod l'maya, v'matfin nura. Avraham says, no, I have a better god. Let's worship water, which puts out fire. It extinguishes fire. So water is seemingly more powerful than fire. Amar le Nimrod, niskod l'maya, great. Nimrod says, great, let's worship water. Sounds good. Amar le Avraham, im kain, niskod l'anana, v'ta'in maya. So Avraham says to Nimrod, okay, well, wait a minute. If you want to worship water, then let's think where water comes from. Better that we should worship the cloud, which bears the water and brings it down as rain, right? Clearly the cloud is the source and the water is the byproduct. So we should worship the source and not the byproduct. To which Nimrod responds in the dialogue, okay, let's worship the cloud. To which Avraham says, well, wait a minute. Let's worship the wind, which can disperse the clouds. And Nimrod thinks about that and says, you're right, wind is clearly more powerful than clouds, if the wind can disperse the clouds. And clouds, obviously, are a better God option than water, because water comes from clouds, and water is a better God option than fire, but still, water can be put out, and water has to come from clouds, and fire is not a good God option because water can put it out. So Nimrod agrees with Avraham that they should worship the clouds, which can disperse worship the wind, which can disperse the clouds, which bear the water, which can put out the fire, which was their original idea for God. So Nimrod says, let's worship the wind. To which Avraham says, well, maybe we should worship mankind, because man, even though we have holes, nostrils in our body, it's pretty amazing. We still keep wind and spirit inside of us. So we're a vessel for wind, so maybe we're more special and more powerful than the wind and the spirit itself. And obviously, what is the conclusion of this midrash? Right? What's Avraham trying to teach? Anybody want to chat in or speak up what Avraham is trying to teach? Avraham is obviously offering a mashal. The midrash is offering a mashal for a parable for Avraham trying to teach monotheism and trying to teach why God alone should be worshipped and not all of the other potential forces that were worshipped in the pagan world and the polytheistic world that he came from. And according to Rav Kasher, how could this be related to Chagadia? First of all, the style is very similar. The argument of Avraham between Avraham and Nimrod of the fire which is put out by the water, which is borne by the clouds, which is dispersed by the wind, which is contained by man. Right, this whole notion of the cumulativeness, the stages, is a similar structure and a similar argument. And the conclusion, right, is not all that different. The conclusion is that it all ends with God and not all of these other stops along the way. And let's just, for clarification's sake, look at the third rabbinic source that Rav Kasher points to that he thinks also may be behind the messages of Chagadia, and then we'll get to our chart. He now quotes a braita, Masechet Bava Batra. B'chein b'Talmud. We have the following braita taught in the Talmud. Asarad dvarim kashim nivru'u ba'olam. 10 very, very hard and difficult things were created in the world. And again, what Rav Kasher is pointing to is both the structure, the style of this teaching, as well as, and then the message. The style begins as follows. Har kasheh, a hard mountain, Barzel nechatcho. Don't worry, right? A hard mountain is not invincible. It can be spliced by, well, we would say dynamite, right? He uses barzel, iron, as the example. Barzel kashe, or mifapo. A hard metal can be melted by ur, by a fire. Ur kashe, a very, very strong fire. Mai mechabimoto. Don't worry, water can put out a strong fire. So our hard mountain, our hard stone, our hard metal, fire, so far are not invincible, even though they seem to be very powerful forces. Mayim kashim, and even very, very, very strong and violent waters, avim sovlimotan, water still came from avim, from clouds that bore the waters. Avim kashim ruach mefazratam. And clouds can be dispersed by wind. Ruach kasha, and a very, very strong, powerful wind. Guf soflo, our human body can contain a strong, powerful spirit, ironically, even though we have holes that should let it out, right? Guf kasha, now is our human body, as Avraham tried to suggest to Nimrod, is our human body the ultimate? Are we invincible? No. Pachad shovro, fear can break down even the strongest human being. Very interesting comment. Pachad kashe. What about fear? Is fear the end? Yain mifigo. No. Wine can ease fear. It can numb fear. Yain kashe. And what about a state of stupor and drunkenness? Is that the end? No. Shena mifachto. Sleep can ease and help somebody get out of their drunkenness and their stupor. Umita kasha mikulam. And death is obviously harder than all of the above and more final than all of the above. And then the Braita continues, Utstaka tatzil min hamita. But don't worry, death, right, even though it is the end of the line, we have an antidote to death. Tzedaka, right, acts of kindness and giving to charity can save from death. The Mishlei teaches that tzedaka can save us from death. So this third source that Rav Kasher brings also has the style of Chagadya, that one to the other, to the other, to the other, to the other, and the seeming thought that one is more invincible than the other, and therefore we've now reached our ultimate. And the final stage is obviously death, but even death has a, so to speak, a way out, and right, the Braita here offers the positive way out of through good deeds and through good acts, we can push off death and save ourselves from death. So these three sources that Rav Kasher points to, the teaching of Hillel in the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, the Midrash about the dialogue between Avraham and Nimrod, and this Braita in Bava Batra, come to both highlight the style of Chagadya. The second two sources in particular that he brings highlight the style of Chagadya as being something that has bases in rabbinic tradition. But all three of them relate to the message of Chagadya. The bottom two, the second two, seem to relate to the theme that it seems that each one is more invincible than the other and is more powerful and we've reached the end, but yet who comes at the end of the day always to settle accounts and to save the day and to be there at the end? God. And of course Hillel's teaching in Pirkei Avot that there is a God in the world and that even somebody that punished someone who deserved to be punished, right, or punished a force that deserved punishment, still may have to be punished if their intentions were not of real justice in the world. But don't worry, says right, Hillel, at the end of the day, there's always God who's going to set the record straight. So we have here a common theme of, at the end, set the record straight, and we have the one to the other leading to the other, but that not necessarily being justice. So with that, with these thoughts in mind, and I think Rav Kasher's sources that he brings us, these three rabbinic sources really do give us a perspective, I'd like to now turn to Chagadya and to the chart you have on the second page, which offers four of the many interpretations that are given of Chagadya. The first three columns, summarizing the commentaries of Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, the Vilna Gaon, and the Chatam Sofer, 18th, and then the Chatam Sofer, early 19th, century major league rabbis and scholars in Eastern Europe. These three views, and we'll go into each one in detail, all relate to Jewish history as a whole. And they view the Chagadya song that we sing at the end of the Seder as collapsing, encapsulating all of Jewish history and singing it in a way, of course, that is accessible to people who have been up till all hours telling Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, including children, telling it in a way that we can remember. It's in a parable. It's not telling a straight history lesson at that hour of the middle of the night, but it's telling the lesson of Jewish history, and the lesson has a theological lesson as well as a historical plot and tale that they tell. Let's look at the first column, that of Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz's commentary to the Haggadah, and I found it simplest to present this to you in chart form, so please follow along in the chart. Since we're moving along in the class, I'm just going to ask if everybody's hearing correctly. Is that if anybody has a problem, please chat in that you're having a problem hearing. Okay, sounds good. According to Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, the little kid in this parable of Chagadya refers to Bnei Yisrael, and Abba, our father Abraham, acquired Bnei Yisrael with two zuzim. According to Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, they are Avraham's traits of mercy and of compassion. In other words, Avraham, through his good actions and his midot, acquired Bnei Israel as his descendants. And what happens to Bnei Israel? Well, what does the story tell us, right? What does the song tell us? This poor little goat, Chad Gadya, that Avraham Avinu acquired through his Maasim Tovim and his good traits of Chesed and Rachamim, well, comes along the cat, Egypt, and eats the goat, makes the Jews slaves 400 years from Avraham Avinu to the end of Yitziat Mitzrayim, suffering, as promised in Bereshit chapter 15. So there comes the cat, Egypt, who eats the goat. But the cat then is bitten by the dog. He has that being Amalek, and I'm going to ask in a minute for somebody's interpretation, which is then hit by the stick, who defeats Amalek when they attack the Jews in Sefer Shemot, right? Moshe's stick, when Moshe raises his arm and he sends his stick down with Yehoshua to go fight the war. And then we have a what we would call a collapsed version of First Temple Jewish history, right? From the Battle of Amalek and the defeat of Amalek, the fire comes to put out the stick. That, says Rabbi Yonathan Eibeshitz, the fire is the fire of the First Temple. But don't worry, that's not the end of Jewish history. Then comes the water, the Persian Empire that rises up and, like water, offers a degree of salvation and revitalization to Jewish history. And the Persian Empire defeats the Babylonians who had burnt the temple. And then comes the ox who drinks the water. Greece, Alexander of Macedon, Alexander the Great, comes and defeats the Persian Empire. But that is not the end of Jewish history, and that's not the end of history, according to the song. Then rises Herod, who's the Shochet, who kills out the remaining Greeks. And then comes the angel of death, Titus, and Rome, and Roman legions, who destroy the temple and seem to bring ultimate death and ultimate exile to the Jewish people. But the song ends that then will God, King of Kings, will come, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu will come in the guise of Mashiach and defeat Rome, settle the accounts. Chad Gadya, Chad Gadya, for being this one chosen people, the children of Abraham that Abraham acquired and deserved and earned with his good deeds and his good traits. Anybody want to comment about Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz's sketch of Jewish history? Things that are interesting that he does include, things that are interesting that he doesn't include. And this is an 18th century retrospective on Jewish history. Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz includes Bnei Yisrael, he includes the various malchuyot, the various kingdoms, along with some others who oppressed Bnei Yisrael throughout history. He includes the two destructions of the temple, and his sketch of Jewish history ends with the optimistic note and the anticipation of the arrival of Mashiach, who, being God's messenger, will set the record straight and restore Bnei Yisrael to their previous. It's clear that all of these punishments of the nations were not just the rise and fall of empires, but they were part of God's plan of Jewish history. And of course, a reading like this would add a lot of meaning at the end of the Seder. Because in our telling of Magid, in our telling of Yitziat Mitzrayim, we make it very, very clear that we're not only talking about Paro, and we're not only talking about Shiabud Mitzrayim, the suffering in Egypt, and we're not only talking about Yitziat Mitzrayim and the redemption from Egypt, but that we're talking about the general picture that is superimposed on Jewish history of Jews suffering, exile, oppression, and God always intervening and redeeming us. Themes and sections of the Haggadah, like Bechol Dor Vador, in each and every generation, Omdim Aleinu L'chaloteinu, they stand above us, they stand over us to oppress us and to kill us, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu Mi'adam, the Jewish history as told by Chad Gadya, according to Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz. Let's take a look at the other two, the Vilna Gaon and the Chatam Sofer, who also view Chad Gadya as telling us about the whole picture of Jewish history, but they tell it a little differently. The Vilna Gaon has the Gdi in his parable, the kid, referring to the Beit HaMikdash, and who purchased the site for Beit HaMikdash. Great. Thank you, Yosef, for asking about Moshe's Mateh, because it also seems to go out of the order, right, of Moshe's staff smiting Amalek. It seems to go out of the order. Thank you, Yosef, for pointing that out. Okay. According to the Vilna Gaon, our parable reads differently. Our parable is the Gzi, the kid in the story, is the Beit HaMikdash that our father, King David, purchased from Arvana HaYevusi, as related in Sefer Shmuel, that he purchased for 2 zuzim, the sum that he purchased to buy the mountain of Moriah, Arvana HaYevusi's, Arvana's stables, the stables there that then became the site of Beit HaMikdash. But what happened to this glorious temple mount? Comes the cat, Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, and destroys the first temple. But then the dog, Bavel comes, Koresh, Melech Paras, Koresh, king of Persia, comes to bite the cat. How does he bite the cat? He allows the Jews to go back and start rebuilding the temple, the beginning of the book of Ezra, the end of the book of Sefer Melachim Bet. And then Jewish history continues, but Koresh's enterprise and the permission offered by the Persian Empire to go and restore the temple in Jerusalem was only temporary, because then came the stick, the Greeks, the Syrian Greeks who defiled the temple. But then came the fire who burnt the stick, the Hashmonai dynasty, the victory of Hanukkah that had a temporary restoration and rededication of the temple, and it's all temple-centric. But then came Rome like water that put out that fire and destroyed the second temple. And then the water was drunk by the Islamic Empire, which rose after the fall of the Roman Empire. And the story is not over. The Shochet will come to destroy Islam, the Shochet being one of the two messianic figures in rabbinic literature, Mashiach ben Yosef, a subject that we could have of another class, why there are two messianic figures and not one. And Mashiach ben Yosef, according to most of the Midrashim in which he's described as a tragic hero, he will die in battle in his attempt to redeem the Jewish people, and he will be killed, so to speak, by the Malach HaMavet. But that's not the end of Jewish history. There will ultimately be HaKadosh Baruch Hu coming, intervening, and redeeming the Jewish people. So the Vilna Gaon also understands Chag Gadya as a song of ultimate redemption, longing for the ultimate redemption, the Acharit HaYamim, and it's a song of all of Jewish history with the Beit HaMikdash at its center. And of course, this would also be very appropriate at the Seder night, where our whole Seder is in lieu of having the Korban Pesach at the Beit HaMikdash. And instead of us having the temple at the center of our evening, right, what do? We tell the story of exile and dispersion and redemption throughout Jewish history and our longing for the temple. We end right before these songs with Shana Haba'a B'Yerushalayim HaBnuya, hoping that next year we won't just be telling, but we'll be actually living this out in Yerushalayim rebuilt with the temple. And what would be a more fitting end to the Seder than a song that sings the parable of all of Jewish history with the temple at the center of the song, and we tell the woes of the rise and fall of the glory and the downfall of the two temples, and we end with our wish for the restoration and God's intervention in Jewish history. The third sketch of Jewish history, that of the Chatam Sofer, is even more Pesach-directed. It doesn't have the temple at the center. It actually has the korbanot of Pesach, the sacrifices of Pesach, at the center. They are the Gedi. They are the literal kid that we are offering and killing on the Seder evening. And that is the Korban Pesach, he suggests, and the Korban Chagigah that we also offer on Pesach. He does not interestingly explain who the Abba is. And he explains that we have to purchase the Korban Chagigah for actual money. That would be the 2 zuzim. And what is the Shunra? He understands Shunra in a figurative sense, that it's Shira Na'ah. He understands Shunra, the Aramaic word, as being a contraction for the Shira Na'ah, the Hallel that we have to sing, the praises of God, the songs of praise that we have to sing, according to the Mishnah, when the Korban Pesach was offered in the temple. And when the dog comes and bites the cat, right, the songs come to an end. What's the dog? The dogs, he says, is the time of the dog's barking, i.e. midnight, when you have to stop eating the Korban Pesach. And at that time, what do you have? You have the stick and you have the fire. You set up, you have the whole mizbeach, you have the wood, and you have the fire on the altar. And the water is reminiscent of the water of washing the Kohanim's hands in the morning of Pesach morning when we wake up. And the ox is the ox of the Korban Chagigah that drank the water in the temple, according to Chazal. And then comes the Shochet who kills the ox. That, he says, are Bnei Yisrael who on Pesach morning got up in the temple and offered their Pesach sacrifices of the Korban Chagigah. And they shechted their animals. And the Malach HaMavet, right now he's moved into Jewish history. We've been talking up till now about the Korbanot of Pesach. So we have a song symbolizing our sacrifices of Pesach night and the next morning. And the song ends with the angel of death killing Bnei Israel who offered their sacrifices so loyally. That is Rome who came and destroyed the temple and brought all of this glorious worship to an end. And ultimately, right, the song ends with God who will come and restore the temple and the temple worship and all of the sacrifices to their previous glory. So the Chatam Sofer has a perspective of Jewish history, but it's very, very different than the previous two that we just saw. He's not involved in the four empires, and he's not involved in the rise and fall of monarchies around the world and the oppression of Jews and exile and redemption. As much as he's involved with the center of the song are all of the sacrificial rites that we did, Pesach evening, Pesach night, and the next morning of the first day of Pesach, and how all of that beautiful glory and sacrifice was brought to an abrupt end with the destruction of the Second Temple. And the song ends with a prayer and a hope that God should restore this immediately. The fourth perspective that I brought, a Hasidic perspective, we will not read each stage, but that reads the song as a parable for Avodat Hashem, for how the soul of the pious Jew worships God. And it understands Gadya in Gematria with its numerical equivalent. It relates it both to the 18 brachot of the Shmona Esrei, the 18 blessings of the daily Amidah, as well as the Torah, which is called Chai. And again, this is all a Mashal. And it relates the patterns and the process that the soul goes through in its attempt to worship God. It has forgetfulness, it has brazenness, it has sin, but all of this can be put out with the fire of the desire to worship God and a burning passion for service of God and with prayer and with Torah. But it also includes the end with what's called the shochet, with the cynical and the contradictory nature of humankind, that even with our great desires to serve God, unfortunately people have a degree of hypocrisy in them, and that is only resolved when someone dies and then their soul is set on a correct unification process with God. So this is an entirely different approach to Chag Gadya. I'm not explaining it in depth. I'm simply bringing it as a totally different perspective to show you that some of the Hasidic masters read Chag Gadya not as a parable for Jewish history in different ways and forms, but as a parable for the soul and the soul's journey of connecting with God. So to conclude, since I know people's lunch break is ending, to conclude, we opened up with a tshuva of the Chidah, criticizing the mocker of Chag Gadya and telling us that clearly the scoffer did not see the depth and the meaning of Chag Gadya and urging us to look for it. And then we saw Rav Kasher, who tried to point to three sources in rabbinic literature that can provide the theological basis for the messages of Chag Gadya, messages of Midah Keneged Midah, of God punishing tit for tat, of God ultimately meeting out punishment, plus for the style of Chag Gadya, one leading to the other, leading to the other, leading to the other, but that is not necessarily representative of justice in the world if the intentions were not correct. And then we saw, when we looked at some of the different commentaries very briefly to Chag Gadya, we saw that several commentaries try and read Chag Gadya as a panoramic sketch of Jewish history. They put different things at the center, Bnei Yisrael, the Beit HaMikdash, or the Korbanot of Pesach at the center. The tale ends, obviously, in each of them with the longing for Yemot HaMashiach and the restoration of Beit HaMikdash and the Korbanot. but they tell Jewish history in different ways, and that their different ways of telling Jewish history encapsulate so many of the messages of Leil HaSeder, and that we have themes of the Chol Dor Vador, we have themes of the centrality of the Korbanot, and we have themes of the longing for Beit HaMikdash, that all can be encapsulated in this beautiful song of Chagadia, which is part of the end of the Seder. So I hope that where we've gone this evening, this afternoon, or this morning, depending on where you're sitting right now, is we've moved past Chagadia being one of the nice songs at the end of the Seder to keep the children up at the end of the night when they're all too tired to stay going, and that we really have here a song with potentially very, very profound theological messages and messages that are very, very much connected to the Seder and to the content and the themes of the Seder. So I hope that this adds some meaning to your Seder and should provide you some interesting food for Divrei Torah at the end or for lunch the next day when people might be a little bit more awake. Chag Kasher v'Sameach. I'm staying on if anybody would like to ask questions by chat or microphone, but I'm releasing everybody else who has to get back to work in their day. Thank you.
Hi, Daphne. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Welcome, Jay.
How you doing? Sorry, I really missed, as you know, like 90% of the shiur, but okay, I just walked in. But I want to say hello and thank you on behalf of everybody. I just heard that from Rav Yonatan Leibchitz on your sort of set, like something about his thing in the film and God.
But. You're very welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining.